Well, this morning we reach the end of Matthew's Gospel, having been in that book since the dawn of time, it feels like. With James, on the other hand, it seems as though we've only just begun, and yet we're already entering this evening the final chapter of the book. It's, I suppose, part of the beautiful variety that you get in the Bible, that not only are its books penned by different authors in different genres, they're also very different lengths. It's because, unlike then many of the world's religious texts, the Bible is not monotonous. It's not this uniform book, samey throughout from beginning to end. It's a lively, enthralling, multidimensional read in keeping with the lively, enthralling, multidimensional God that it reveals. Anyway, as I say, we're entering this evening the final chapter of this book of James, and in the 8 verses that lie before us just now, there are 4 things that I want us to consider. And first of all, a cruel reality. A cruel reality. So partway through our passage, the ESV has one of its breaks, a gap, and a new heading in bold type. Sometimes breaks like that are helpful. This one, however, is not. It encourages us to read verses 1-6 as a self-contained unit. Now, if those verses are a self-contained unit, it seems to me that James is behaving very strangely here. Basically, he launches into a 6-verse rant about a particular social ill, greedy, exploitative landowners, and gets that off his chest before suddenly remembering in verse 7 that he's actually writing a pastoral letter addressing the needs of a bunch of Christians, and so he kind of drags himself back on track and resumes the kind of wise counsel and edifying instruction that has dominated the book so far. That's what's going on if, as the ESV break suggests, verses 1-6 are a self-contained unit. But they're not a self-contained unit. One word in verse 7 makes that immediately obvious. It's the word therefore. Therefore. That's telling us that the wise counsel and edifying instruction from verse 7 onwards isn't James getting back on track after a wild digression about greedy landowners. Rather, the wise counsel and edifying instruction from verse 7 onwards relates to what he has just said about these greedy landowners. That's the point of the therefore. It's precisely because of these greedy landowners that James now has to impart some serious pastoral guidance to his readers. Why? What's the link? Well, I would put it to you that this is the link. Look at verse 4. And addressing these landowners, by the way, James, in verses 1-6, I don't think he's addressing these landowners, expecting the landowners to hear what he's saying. They're not in the church by any means. This is a very Old Testament prophetic sort of device. You remember how the prophets would denounce the nations around Israel? And of course, those nations were never going to hear what the prophet said. But this was a technique that they used, and James, I think, is using the same technique here. So addressing these landowners in verse 4, James refers to their laborers, the early part of the verse, their harvesters, the later part of the verse, whose wages they, the landowners, are failing to pay. Well, those unpaid farm workers, they include in their ranks some of the Christians to whom James is writing. That's the point. In other words, this isn't some random social ill that just happens to have gotten under James's skin. This is a social ill that James's very readers are caught up in. They are among its victims. They are on the receiving end of this despicable exploitation. And we need to try to appreciate just how devastating this situation would have been for them. I was listening to the radio the other day, and a woman was talking about the impact of the lockdowns on her particular industry, the tourism industry and the companies that are collapsing and the workers who are being made redundant and so on. And she made this comment. She said, people save for a rainy day, but they don't save for a rainy year. Well, in James's first century context, the vast majority of people didn't even save for a rainy day. There were exceptions, of course, those prosperous merchants that we encountered in last week's passage, but most people didn't have secure jobs with contracts and all that kind of stuff. They were like the workers in Jesus' parable there in Matthew 20, looking for work each day so that at the end of the day they could go back home with a bit of money that would purchase tomorrow's food. That's how they lived. It truly was a hand-to-mouth existence, and unpaid wages, therefore, were not a blow. They were not a setback. They were absolutely catastrophic. That, I think, is why James says to these landowners in verse 6, you have murdered. You have murdered. Now, we encountered that word, you remember, murder, back in chapter 4, verse 2. And there I said it's not meant literally. It's a reference to angry, malicious, aggressive behavior, which differs in degree, of course, from murder, but arises from the same underlying impulse of the heart. Here in chapter 5, verse 6, it's still not quite meant literally, in that these landowners weren't actually laying their hands murderously on their laborers, but it's closer to being literal here. Because the point is that unpaid wages really did threaten the very lives of these harvesters and their families. In that economic climate, it was a terrifyingly small step from unpaid wages to starvation. Whether any of these Christians actually had died as a result of this, we can't be sure, but it was certainly well within the bounds of possibility. And so you can see why my first heading is a cruel reality. It was a very cruel reality indeed that some of James's Christian readers were experiencing. The daily pay on which they absolutely depended being held back. The inability to acquire life's most basic necessities, a real issue. It was truly a nightmarish situation that these Christians were in. And it's a reminder then that nightmarish situations can be the lot of Christians just as much as anyone else. The idea that being a Christian exempts a person from life's cruelest realities is utter nonsense. Anyone who thinks like that cannot have read very much of the Bible at all, and certainly cannot have read James chapter 5, because here are these people, and they are children of God and heirs of everlasting life, and their names are written in heaven, but they still have aching stomachs and empty cupboards and children in the early stages of malnutrition. The Bible is candid and unvarnished on this point, that in a world of suffering and pain, evil and injustice, the people of God enjoy no immunity. A cruel reality. But then notice with me, secondly this evening, a curious remedy. A curious remedy. This passage sheds light on chapter 1. Of the letter. You remember how the letter begins there with James talking about his readers' trials. And there he doesn't spell out what those trials are. Now, however, we get a window into the kind of suffering that's going on, the threat of starvation, as we've talked about, as a result of unpaid wages. There in chapter 1, James focuses on the role which trials fulfill in the Christian life, the way in which they develop steadfastness in us. Do you remember that language that he uses there? And you can imagine his readers getting to chapter 5 here. And as the letter returns now to this matter of the difficulties which they are facing, perhaps these readers are saying to themselves, okay, James, please don't go on again about how useful these trials are, strengthening us in our Christian faith and in our Christian discipleship. We get that point, James. We get that. Please tell us something else now. Please tell us how we can be free from these trials, how we can get out of them. We'd love you to tell us that, please, James. Please tell us the remedy, the way of ending this cruel reality that we're suffering. That, James, is what we want to hear. You can imagine his readers saying to themselves something like that. Well, that, in fact, is precisely what James does do here. He tells them the remedy. But it's not the kind of remedy which they might have been expecting. Because the remedy to their suffering, which James talks about, is not some kind of resistance movement, besieging the landowners' mansions and lobbing bricks at their windows until they start coughing up the wages. The remedy to their suffering that James talks about is not some kind of appeal to the landowners to set up a process of arbitration. No, the remedy to their suffering that James talks about is that phrase that appears twice in verses 7 and 8, the coming of the Lord. The coming of the Lord. That is the coming of the Lord Jesus, the second coming, as we often call it, to distinguish it from his coming in the virgin birth. That is the remedy. Because then the landowner's exploitation will end. Then it will end. In fact, James says, then at the coming of the Lord, it will more than just end. There will be, he describes, an extraordinary reversal. Let me draw your attention quickly to two aspects of this reversal. Number one, the condemners will then be condemned. The condemners will then be condemned. I mentioned a moment ago, verse 6, and the reference there to murder. But notice there's also a reference there to condemnation. You have condemned and murdered the righteous person. Clearly, for these rich landowners, withholding pay wasn't enough to satisfy their greed. It didn't sufficiently scratch their itch simply to withhold pay from their laborers. They had to also strip their laborers of every last thing they had. And so they were dragging them before courts of law. James has already referred to that, you may remember, back in chapter 2, verse 6. Of course, they didn't have any proper case whatsoever to bring against these laborers of theirs. They weren't actually doing anything wrong, but doubtless with their clout within the community, these landowners could make sure they got the verdicts they wanted. They could get their poor, defenseless employees condemned. It was the most sickening kind of behavior. But look at what James says in verse 3. He uses that phrase in the middle of verse 3, evidence against you. Evidence against you. That is legal court language. And he's talking about that event, the coming of the Lord. And he's saying that then on that day, the tables are going to be turned. Then it will be the landowners in the dock, in the Lord's dock, facing his justice, no less. Interestingly, he says the evidence against these men on that day will be the corrosion of their gold and silver. Your gold and silver have corroded, and their corrosion will be evidence against you. What does he mean? Well, this is the point. Why has their gold and silver corroded? Well, because it hasn't been used. It hasn't been used in the way that it should have been used, paying the harvesters their wages. Instead, it has been laid up, James says in verse 3, in vaults and coffers and safes, corroding away there. And so that corrosion will be damning evidence against them. And they will then be condemned. So that's the first aspect of the reversal. The condemners will then be condemned. And then number two, the eaters will then be eaten. The eaters will then be eaten. Verse 5 talks about the luxury and self-indulgence in which these landowners live. And it refers to them fattening their hearts. Hearts here is probably being used loosely. It's their stomachs that James has in mind. In other words, they are becoming fat through overeating. But look at verse 3 again. And on that day, James says, on that day when the Lord comes, they won't be eating fine delicacies then. They will be eaten. Their flesh, James says, their flesh will be eaten. He uses this horrid picture of the same corrosion that is now eating away at their hoarded gold and silver, that same corrosion on that day spreading to their very bodies and eating away at them. You know, the Bible talks quite a bit about the believer's glorified resurrection body. It never, however, explores in detail the unbeliever's counterpart to that, the unbeliever's non-glorified resurrection body. The unbeliever will have a resurrection body. Several texts are quite clear on that. But the Bible never explores in detail what the unbeliever's non-glorified resurrection body will be like. But there are hints. One is Daniel 12, verse 2, which refers to that resurrection body, the unbeliever's resurrection body, being enveloped in shame and contempt. That's the language used. And here perhaps is another hint. That resurrection body, the unbeliever's resurrection body, will be this horribly corroded thing, like a piece of corroded metal, incomplete and disfigured and dysfunctional. That's the picture that James is painting. You can see why he begins then in verse 1, come now, you rich, weep and howl for the miseries that are coming upon you, that are coming upon you then on that day when everything will be reversed. So this is the remedy to which James points his beleaguered, suffering readers, the coming of the Lord and the reversal that will take place then. And if that would perhaps have seemed a curious remedy to them, I'm sure it seems even more curious to us, because we are surely more aware than any previous generation of things that can be done here and now to alleviate suffering. If the suffering is from illness and disease, then medicine can help. If the suffering is from unjust criminal treatment, then police and lawyers and government can help. If the suffering is from earthquakes and floods, then modern engineering techniques can help. That's how we think. And of course, those helps are not in themselves wrong. They are, in fact, gifts from God, and it's proper to make use of them. But actually, you know, the real remedy for us is still exactly the same as it was for James's readers back then. And the danger is that in all our advance and in all our progress and in all our sophistication and in all our technology, we can lose sight of that. The real remedy is still the coming of the Lord. Still that. That's what will end our trials properly. And that's the remedy that you and I should be most conscious of. That's the remedy that should be most on our radars. And if it seems terribly silly and naive, me talking like that in 2020, then that simply shows how far we have drifted from a biblical way of thinking. Thinking biblically means saying to oneself, this trial that I am currently experiencing, what that trial really needs is not a blast of this modern solution or a blast of that modern solution. What this trial really needs is Jesus Christ to rend the heavens and come with his angel train and end history and consummate all his promises. That's what this trial I'm presently experiencing really needs. Is that your way of thinking? A cruel reality, a curious remedy. Thirdly, this evening, a comforting reliability, a comforting reliability. The coming of the Lord shows no sign of materializing. You walk about today, you read the newspaper, watch television, go online, look up into the sky when you're outside. Nowhere will you see any sign of the coming of the Lord materializing. It was the same, of course, for James's readers, but James is insistent nonetheless on its comforting reliability. This is a reliable event. This is something that we can rely on. As I said in my prayer, though all else may be pervaded by uncertainty, this is an event that can be relied on. And it can be relied on, James says, on at least two grounds. First of all, an unfolding program. An unfolding program. You see, the Old Testament set out various salvation events that would take place in the future. There would be the advent of the long-promised Messiah. There would be the death, the atoning death of the Messiah. There would be the glorious rising again of the Messiah. There would be his ascension into heaven. There would be the outpouring of the Spirit. And there would be the coming again in glory of the Messiah. Now, all except one of those events have occurred. All except one have occurred. There's only the coming of the Messiah in glory and splendor at the end. There's only that still to occur. That's why James refers then to these in verse 3 as the last days. As we often say, he's neither he nor any of the other New Testament writers who use that kind of language are saying that this is definitely going to happen soon, as we would use that vocabulary, like in the next year or the next decade or the next century or the next millennium. But the point is, it's the only event left to happen in God's salvation timetable. Why he can say at the end of verse 8, the coming of the Lord is at hand. Again, he's not saying that it's about to happen in a very short chronological period from now. He's saying it's the only event remaining on the salvation timetable. Verse 5, he refers, we've already talked about that phrase, these landowners have fattened their hearts. He says, in a day of slaughter. The day of slaughter is Old Testament terminology, again, for the day of the Lord, the day of judgment, the day when God will slaughter his enemies. And James is saying that you landowners have fattened yourselves with that day and its shadow looming over you, because it's the next event now. And the point is then it's ridiculous to think that God's salvation program is going to falter now, when it hasn't faltered at any previous stage, when all the other events have indeed happened just as it was said they would happen, it's ridiculous to think that now, at this advanced stage, the whole thing is going to collapse and the great crowning event isn't going to take place. It's reliable. It's reliable. God's unfolding program points us to that. So that's one reason it's reliable, an unfolding program. The second, a responsive God. A responsive God. And justice is integral, isn't it, to the character of God. You read the Old Testament Psalms, and so often it comes out there that God is a just God, a righteous God, a God who exercises and executes justice. And hence, James depicts him in verse 4 in beautiful language, so aware and sensitive, so aware of and sensitive to the cries of these harvesters as they cry out in despair about these unpaid wages. God, this God of justice, he hears those cries. And because then he is a God of justice, because he's a responsive God, he must eventually respond to those cries and bring justice. He must do that. If you know anything about God, then he must do that. Indeed, that's the point, I think, of James mentioning using that title, the Lord of Hosts. It's pointing, whenever it's used, that phrase to God's armies. Probably sometimes the armies of Israel in the Old Testament, but usually his angelic armies. And the point here then, I think, is that God already then has his armies of angels lined up, ready for the cue, ready for the signal, ready to come, surging down from heaven on that last day to pounce upon the enemies and slaughter them, in the language of verse 5, and judge them and deal with them. And every time now one of God's suffering, beleaguered people cries out, it's as if God kind of repositions those armies of angels behind him, make sure they're ready to come surging down. He hears your cries, maybe not about someone exploiting you. It's your cries about the pain you're suffering, the trouble, the burden you're grappling with. He hears that. He's a responsive God. And his characteristic responsiveness means that he must one day finally say, it's time for my son to come, it's time for suffering to end, it's time for my people to be comforted, it's time for vindication, it's time for justice to be established. So for those two reasons then, this unfolding program that must run its full course, this responsive God who must respond to the desperate cries of his people. For those two reasons, James is saying, my readers, you can count on this. You can count on this. It will happen. The Lord will come. I don't know when, but it will come. He will come. It will happen. Yes, there is a comforting reliability about this event. So a cruel reality, a curious remedy, a comfort and reliability. But then fourthly and finally, a clear responsibility. A clear responsibility. And it's that exhortation twice in verses 7 and 8. Be patient. Be patient. In the light of all this, James says to to his readers. Be patient. And I think we need to understand what he means by that. I don't think he's saying be patient in relation to the coming of the Lord, even though it's taking so long to transpire. He's not saying, look, you should just have the attitude, well, he'll come when he comes, and therefore I better just get on with life. Because that would contradict other passages in the New Testament where Christians are depicted as being frustrated almost and discontented until that day does arrive. You know, Paul talks, doesn't he, in Philippians 3:13 about straining towards the end. Or he talks about believers groaning for the end. He talks about loving the appearing of Christ. So we're not to be patient in relation to the coming of the Lord. That is, we're not to say, well, it'll happen when it happens, and so I better not think about it too much and just let it happen in its own time. No, we should be crying out for it. Come, Lord. We should be wanting it desperately, and there should be a holy impatience about us in relation to that. James's point rather is this: be patient in relation to these trials, these trying circumstances you're facing, now that you know the coming of the Lord will end. That's James's point. Be patient in relation to these trials you're suffering, knowing that the coming of the Lord is on the cards. It will transpire and your trials will all end. And in order then to demonstrate that patience, he says that you must establish, verse 8, or strengthen your hearts. In other words, strengthen your hearts with this coming of the Lord perspective, so that you view all your trials through the lens, through the grid of the Lord is coming. The Lord is coming. Strengthen your hearts until that's how your hearts beat. I wonder, did you have a strong heart? I'm not asking there about your blood pressure or your cholesterol levels. Do you have a heart that beats in that way, viewing your trials, your struggles, through the lens of the coming of the Lord? Strengthen your hearts. Not strengthen your arguments about the end times. So the next time you're in a ding-dong with another Christian about what's going to happen at the end, you can beat that person. So often the end becomes this theological battleground, doesn't it? So desperately so. Now strengthen your hearts with the conviction that Jesus is coming. And when Jesus comes, all suffering will end. Strengthen your hearts with that. We do seem to look forward to the Lord's coming so much less than our Christian forebears when you read the old literature. They didn't have much medical help. They didn't have much technology to make life comfortable. And they saw clearly that it's not that stuff that's the remedy. It's Jesus coming back. And they longed for that. And they thought in those terms, intuitively. And for us, it's so often just a chapter in our systematic theology textbooks. It's an event that we'll argue about. We know it. It's there in our theology, but it's not this hope that drives us, shapes how we think every day. God, help us to have it not in our heads, but in our hearts. The Lord is coming. The Lord is coming. The Lord is coming. My situation now is painful, but the Lord is coming. I'm struggling right now, but the Lord is coming. Life's hard, but the Lord is coming. There's so many heartaches and headaches and confusing, perplexing details in my life, but the Lord is coming. God help us to have that perspective. Amen. We're going to close singing, Rejoicing in